last time I talked to you, it was on the occasion of The Broken Cord.
Yes.
It's a fascinating book.
Yes.
And we just couldn't get our date straight for the Crown of
Columbus. Oh, right, yes.
I would have liked to talk to you and your wife, Louise Erdrich, about that. How'd the book do? I know it got terrific reviews.
Well, I think it did fine. It was on the bestseller list for a couple of months, and the paperback mass market came out recently, and it also did very well. I think it sold several hundred thousand copies, amazingly.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I guess, in a way, Morning Girl is kind of an offshoot from your research into that.
It certainly is. One of the things that we read in Columbus's diary is that he said that among the first people he met in the Western Hemisphere was one very young girl. And so I, in trying to write my first children's book, wanted to concoct her story in the couple of months preceding the encounter. The only thing I knew about it when I began the book was that it would end before they actually met, because I wanted it to be her story rather than her story in reaction to his arrival.
Well, since we've launched into a discussion of Morning Girl already, let's go ahead and talk a little more about it. You set the story in the Bahamas, is that not correct?
That's right, yes.
In approximately 1492.
Yes.
Tell me about the natives of that land.
Well, we know very little about them. Their name that has come down to us are the Taino, if that in fact is how it's pronounced. We know what they wore. We would know what they ate. We know something about their language. We know what the weather was like. We know what Columbus says of them, and that is that they were handsome, that they were hospitable, that they had no prior knowledge of weapons, and that they had no fear. And so within that parameter, because they didn't leave a written record, I tried to devise a story about a brother and a sister that wouldn't violate any of those things, but wouldn't hit you over the head with them either. So living in a small community, one could imagine that everybody knew everybody else's business. I made a brother and sister who had an ongoing rivalry. She was partial to the early morning and he to the night, more to differentiate themselves from each other than anything else, I think. And in the course of the book, this pair of siblings, I hope, moves from just kind of a blind polarity through a couple of difficult experiences. Their mother has a miscarriage. There is a storm. Morning Girl gets to see what she looked like. Small little incidents, but important to them. They move toward who they might be as adults if they had had the chance to be adults, which they didn't.
The information about these natives, were they found in records going back to Columbus?
They are found in reports of the Spaniards, and also they were an Arawak-speaking group, we know that, and there are still Arawak-speaking groups in Venezuela and in other parts of the Caribbean, so by inference we can know something about them. But really, the main source of information about the Taino is Columbus's diary and his record of initial encounter.
What happened to them?
They all died of European diseases, and some of them were brought back to Spain as slaves. They had no immunity to old world diseases, and consequently, without anyone meaning for it to happen, I think, at that point in time, they simply succumbed, which proved the theory of Europeans that they were superior, and probably devastated and demoralized the native people because they didn't know what was happening. In fact, demographers now tell us that probably 19 out of every 20 people who were alive in the Western Hemisphere at the time of initial encounter died shortly thereafter from the spread of European diseases, for which neither they nor Europeans had a medicine.
To what age group have you directed Morning Girl?
I have a daughter 7 and a daughter 8, and they listened when it was read aloud to them. I think that's probably the starting age, and I noticed in the Hyperion Books catalog it is described as 8 and up, so I don't think I want to put a cap on it.
It's geared for children, but certainly I read the book thoroughly. It's, of course, being geared for children. It's a very short book, so I could read it in an hour or so. But I found it fascinating as an adult. So I think anybody could read the book and enjoy it.
Actually, I wrote it exactly the same way I've written adult fiction, and that is with first-person narrators. And when you have a character who addresses the reader in the I, and I am doing this, and this is how I feel, the interior monologue, you are constricted by only knowing what they know and only seeing what they see and only using the vocabulary that they could use, whether it's an old man or an old woman or a college professor like Roger Williams in The Crown of Columbus or these two kids. But I figured if the characters worked, they should be accessible to people their own age. And Morning Girl is set at about 12 and Starboy at about 10.
Now, you've told me in the past that your work with Louise Erdrich is a collaboration. Can that be said about Morning Girl?
Well, the only true, absolute collaboration of ours, actually there are two in fiction. One is The Crown of Columbus, which has both of our names, and the other actually is nonfiction. It's a little small press book called Route 2, which is a travel book, which also has both of our names. But the books that have either her name or my name mean that the person whose name is on the book actually was the primary originator of the story, and the other person was the red pencil and the person who said, go in this direction, go in that direction, scrap this, and every once in a while maybe put a little star in the margin, which was meant for encouragement, I hope. So she did that a lot. I would write this, as I write almost everything, early in the morning, and then take it into her over coffee and the page or two that had come out, and if she liked it, she had a second cup and read it, and if she looked away, I knew I had to go back upstairs and try again.
What's it like living with a critic and editor?
Well, it has its moments. Of course, when your critic and editor is Louise Erdrich, I think, you know, it's a pretty good deal. We have both, I think, come to depend upon that role, and the other person symbolically perches on our shoulder, even when we're not physically present, because there are certain things I know I can't get by Louise, and so it's just not worth the effort or the argument to try. I always overwrite, and so she always has me start the story about a page after I have begun it and always end it about a page before I have ended it, because I tend to over-explain. And so in that sense, it's a very valuable thing, because I think it allows us, that role allows each of us to take risks that we wouldn't otherwise take, because we know that the partner is going to be honest, and we also know from past experience that it's harder to say this doesn't work when somebody is very enthusiastic about something than it is to say it's terrific. And hard as it may be to hear that, we depend on it.
Well, you are both the professionals. I'm an amateur writer myself, and I found that if I gave copies of anything I wrote, which is fiction, to a neighbor in my building, or to my former wife, it was meaningless. They had no ability to be able to judge it as a professional. I mean, they might like it, or they might not like it, but they really couldn't tell whether this would be a publishable piece of work. That's the difference, I think. Most people, most writers, might find it difficult to give their work to a spouse, simply because spouse is not in the business.
Well, we would have a hard time, I think, even with somebody else in the business, either of us giving work before it was finished. It's a relationship we never anticipated happening, and now that it's here, it's almost automatic. But it isn't without its perils, you know. It isn't without one or the other of us tossing the manuscript across the room and saying, "I'll never write again." But I think I trust that. Louise really believes in my work, and I certainly really believe in hers, and consequently, whatever tough things you have to say, and the early drafts are full of tough things, I would say anything that goes out of our house has been through 12 or 13 drafts, you have to acknowledge that it is not said with anything other than a constructive air, and since I admire her work, I figure she knows what she's talking about.
So there's no sulking.
Oh, yes. Yeah, there's a lot of that. but I think that the sulk time is shorter than it used to be, because we have both learned that it doesn't help. You know, the other person doesn't change and say, "I was wrong, you were right." They just endure until we come around and to the other person and talk as you said, like a professional.
Have you networked your computers?
No, that we have not done.
Why don't you do that?
Well, actually, we both write longhand first, so yeah. it wouldn't do any good. And I think one of the things we don't want to do is see anything before the other person is ready to show us and sit with their arms crossed across the table and see what we think.
Now, you have a real affinity for Native Americans, and there's a reason for that. Can you talk about, address that?
Well, I'm a mixed blood, as is Louise. On my father's side, I'm Modoc, and on my mother's side, I'm Irish Catholic. And it's a combination that came into being at a USO dance at Fort Knox, Kentucky, many years ago. I lived part of my life on reservations. I was trained as an anthropologist and taught anthropology and Native American studies for 15 years at Dartmouth College. So it's been pretty much my life. And as the professor in Little Women said to Joe, write what you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think Dorothy Parker said the opposite, write what you don't know. But
now you write about your adopted son in The Broken Cord. And that you actually, as a bachelor, adopted this child. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
I adopted three children as a single parent.
Is that hard to do?
You mean technically?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of unusual.
I was actually the first man to do it, it turns out. This was back in 1971, and I had been the child of single parents, or a single parent, and my mother had been the child and been raised by a single parent, so it didn't seem like such a big deal to me. I wasn't married. I was 25 years old, and I wanted to be a father. And so I was lucky enough to work through Catholic Social Services, and a placement was made almost to the day 9 months after I initiated it. It was a perfectly normal pregnancy. And then a couple of years after that, I adopted another son and then a daughter. And after being a single parent for a decade, I got married, and now Louise and I have three more children.
So you have, or had, a total of six, because the first child you adopted, Abel,
yes,
who figures prominently in the Broken Cord, did ultimately die. Now, tell me a little bit about what happened. I interviewed you with regard to the Broken Cord, and that story is certainly worth a postscript. Because here was a child who had fetal alcohol syndrome.
That's right.
With all of the incumbent problems that children like that have. And it was a very moving and poignant story in which your child actually wrote a chapter himself.
Yes, he did.
Just give me a follow-up. What happened after the book?
Well, the book, I think, had an impact, which is why it was written and why our family sacrificed an enormous amount of privacy for a very long time, because we hoped that other people, through the lesson of Abel's life, could avoid the mistakes that his birth mother made, I'm sure unintentionally, and that is to drink during her pregnancy. I think there have been some policy aftershocks. I gave the keynote address a couple of years ago at the Centers for Disease Control with the first international conference on fetal alcohol syndrome. Senator Tom Daschle and the Senate has introduced a number of bills that would expand Medicaid for FAS, as has Representative Ben Nighthorse Campbell, the only American Indian congressman. And I think probably through the film that was made of the book, which starred Jimmy Smits and was aired on television last year, and which will eventually come out on video, maybe the idea has gotten into the folklore. That was our intent. That's why we let the book be made. Louise wrote the introduction. Abel wrote the postscript. As you say, he was killed last year. He was hit by a car coming home from work. I don't think it had anything to do with his illness. It was, I think, an act of carelessness on the part of the driver. But because he was disabled, it was not investigated very long, and there weren't any witnesses. Needless to say, it's very hard to talk about, and it's hard to talk about. I haven't seen the movie.
You did not see the film?
No. Why? No. It's a little too surreal to see your life on screen, and I think both Louise and I wanted to keep our memories as they are rather than have them colored by something. I think it was a good movie. I worked on the screenplay with Annie Beckett, who wrote it, and I went for a couple of days while it was being filmed in Toronto to consult just to make sure that it didn't get sentimentalized. But it was critically well received and has won. It won the Scott Newman Award this year, which is the one given for Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward's son, who died from a drug overdose, I believe. And it's an award given every year for the media that does most to discourage drug or alcohol abuse. And it also won the Media Award from the American Psychology Association. So I think it accomplished exactly what we hoped. It doesn't make it easy.
Well, to go on to some lighter things, you have a rock group that you had mentioned. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, we really are swinging from one extreme to the other, and I will try and switch gears. This is a group of authors called the Rock Bottom Remainders, and I must take credit for the name. We had a contest, and they chose my name. Remainders are those books normally in hardcover that don't sell and always wind up on the remainder tables. And it is a group that was organized by a woman in San Francisco named Kathy Goldmark, who actually is a musician, but on the side acts as an author escort when you go on tour. And I think she had endured listening to a number of us go on wistfully about how we had once played in bands in high school and this and that, and so she decided that we should put our money where our mouth is, organized a band, and it's made up of Stephen King and Dave Barry on guitar and Ridley Pearson, Barbara Kingsolver on keyboards, Amy Tan as a remainderette, a singer, and a number of other people, and myself on percussion, I think we would call it. And we performed at the American Booksellers Association in Anaheim last year for the homeless, it was for charity. And today, there is a release party. BMG has done a rock video of our performance, and it will be for sale in stores and music stores, and heaven forbid, maybe on television or something. The review that I recall best was one in L.A. of someone who came to the two sets, who suggested that we keep our day jobs. But it was fun, and maybe we should be called the Talking Dogs, but we do things like Land of a Thousand Dances, Bye Bye Love, Da Do Run Run, the songs that most of us grew up on.
Well, Ridley Pearson was here in the studio, and he brought his guitar in.
Yes, he's wonderful.
Concert, and he had...
He was
a professional.
He is certainly one of the cornerstones of the group, and let us say he has the live mic.
You guys are spread out so much. How do you practice?
Well, maybe that's one of the problems. We send tapes back and forth, and we keep the fax machines going, and we bluff a lot, actually. So I don't know. I mean, I don't think we're going to change the history of rock and roll, but we may raise a little more money for these good causes, which is why we're doing it, that and the Ham Factor, probably.
So is this going to be an ongoing project with a good motive?
There is talk that we will play again at the American Booksellers Convention in Miami this coming spring, but I think we're sort of playing it by ear, one song at a time.
Well, just to look ahead a little bit, tell me what projects you and Louise Zickrick have in the works.
Louise is finishing a new novel. Actually, she's close to finishing two. One is called The Bingo Palace, which is connected to her three previous books. And another is called Tales of Burning Love, many parts of which have been published in magazines already. I have coming out next season a book of short stories called Working Men, and also, at the same time, from another publisher, a book of essays called Paper Trail. And, of course, we're both at work on other children's books because it has been such a pleasant experience to get to know the children's librarians. I am a little bit of a tour for this book, and I was just in Waterville, Maine, at Colby College, and an independent bookstore there organized 400 fifth graders to come to an old Baroque movie theater to hear me read the sections from the book and ask questions. And they stayed for 2 hours and couldn't ask enough questions. It was I told these fifth graders that I was going to shame every audience I had and among adults for the rest of my life because they were so vocal. And one of the things that they objected to particularly in a consciousness-raising way is that why was the book called Morning Girl instead of Morning Girl and Star Boy, because Star Boy was at least 50% of the book.
That's a good question.
It is a good question. I wonder if it would have been asked if the book was called Star Boy and Morning Girl's name wasn't there. I mean,
So what did you tell them?
Well, I told them that Morning Girl, as the quite young girl that Christopher Columbus saw, was the only person that I absolutely knew existed. And so, since she begun the book, in the same sense that Louise's and my collaborations are always given the title of the person who really initiated it, it was her call this time, and he has to come up with his own book next time.
Well, now the book sells for $12.95. Actually, I guess it's going to take an adult to buy the book, right?
Well, or a very precocious child, I guess. Or a library.
So. Or a library.
Yes.
I would imagine that most young adult books... Would this be considered a young adult? I guess a young adult would actually be a teenager, wouldn't it?
These are all new terms to me, too. I'm not sure.
That's what they usually don't call it, a juvenile fiction list. They call it a young adult or something.
This is, I think, technically called a chapter book because it doesn't have pictures, and it depends upon the imagination of the reader to populate it.
It does have a photograph of a young girl on the cover.
It's an interesting story with that photograph. Actually, it isn't a photograph. It's a painting.
Ah.
It's a painting by...
Very
realistic painting by a wonderful Vietnamese artist. And they sent me the pictures of several possible models, and nobody looked exactly like I imagined Morning Girl would look. And I finally suggested to Ellen Levine, the art director at Hyperion, that she simply go over to the American Indian Community House here in New York and ask the first person she met, what 12-year-old girl do you know who has a great smile? And that's what they did, and there she is on the cover.
Well, Morning Girl is a beautiful book, Michael, and I thank you very, very much for coming in.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. Thank you.